four of General Qasem Soleimani, Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, and others is too dear to be left unpunished, as will be seen in the near future, no matter under what screens of security the criminals hide. Palestine Declassified.
Welcome to another episode of Palestine Declassified, where we examine the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. We'll be talking to the founders of Palestine Action this week, a group that successfully chased Israel's largest arms company from its London headquarters and forced it to sell its subsidiary for anti-technologies in Oldham. I'll be speaking to experts to find out more after this report by Bianca Rahimi on this unprecedented victory against Israel in the UK.
The heroic Palestine Action campaign against the largest Israeli arms company, Elbit Systems, has taken many twists and turns. From activists being arrested and placed on remand, to many being acquitted from court cases, even by magistrates, one thing has remained true. Elbit Systems fears the disinfectant of sunlight. As Israel's number one manufacturer of killer drones and other murder machines, Elbit Systems has a gruesome reputation. It has recently been thought to own the company which manufactured the bullet which killed Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akla. It has also been a key player in the building of the illegal apartheid wall in the West Bank. It also has numerous large contracts with the British Ministry of Defence. Despite this, Palestine Action has again and again shut down Elbit Systems factories in the country. Just a few months ago, we reported here on Palestine Declassified that the group forced Elbit Systems to sell one of its subsidiaries in the sleepy English town of Oldham at a loss. Ferranti Technologies was sold by Elbit Systems for £9 million, which is millions of pounds less than what it was acquired for. This was thanks to the coordination of the local community and Oldham Peace and Justice alongside Palestine Action. Initially, this was contested by the company, which claimed the sale of Ferranti was merely due to a reorganizing of their portfolio. However, later in a court case, it was admitted by the UK Crown Prosecution Service that Elbit was forced out of Oldham by Palestine Action. Now, there is more great news of Elbit's retreat from the UK. We are happy to announce that the London campaign by Palestine Action has forced Israel's largest arms company, Elbit Systems, to abandon its London headquarters for good. This is an iconic moment in the global struggle against Israel. It has been confirmed that Elbit Systems have vacated the offices of their HQ in retreat from the marching tide of Palestine Action. Good riddance to Elbit Systems. Long live Palestine Action.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. And he's a co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog, Spinwatch. I'm also pleased to say that we're joined today by two founders of Palestine Action. As I said at the top of the show, this is the group that shut down two Elbit Systems sites in just 6 months. This stunning achievement is a true testament to their tenacity. I'm joined in the studio by Huda Mori. She's a Palestinian-Iraqi activist who's been involved in the Palestine struggle for many, many years. And Richard Barnard joins us via Skype. Richard's another founder of Palestine Action, who I understand is currently banned from London by the Metropolitan Police. Thanks to both of you for joining us and welcome to the show. Let me start with you, if I can, Huda. I mean, how did Palestine Action force Elbit to sell its subsidiary for anti-technologies in Oldham?
So the Elbit subsidiary in Oldham was actually a target for local campaigners for many years. And Palestine Action launched in July 2020. And we were determined to take direct action against all of Elbit sites in Britain in order to force them out of these towns like Oldham. And so many activists had locked on under caravans to block the roads, had locked on to the front doors to block the entrances. People had climbed on top of the roof. Some actually broke into the building and damaged the machinery and weapons that were being built in Oldham. And basically, it was a campaign of making it impossible for them to continue to operate. There were activists regularly making sure that that site was shut down. And that's really our strategy, is to continue to shut them down day in and day out in some cases until they cannot operate here anymore. Because as long as they operate, more weapons are going to be made, which is going to continue to aid the ongoing occupation and colonisation of Palestine.
What was the reaction of the local community? Excuse me.
The local community, actually in places like Oldham and also in Leicester and other places across the country where Elbit's factories are, there is a high Asian community, a high Kashmiri community, which was very frustrated, to be honest, when they found out that this factory was even there in the first place. And many of them regularly protested outside the site week in and week out at some points. Towards the end, they had gone for 30 weeks straight, going outside that factory on a weekday, you know, taking time out of their normal tasks in order to show that factory that they were not welcome there.
No, indeed. And I understand that the FBU, the fire brigade, was called out, and the fire brigade union refused to operate with the police in removing the protesters in Leicester as well, which was quite a thing. But let me go to Richard, if I can, who's joining us, as I say, from Skype. I mean, what made you get involved in direct action, Richard? And can you say a little bit about why you've been banned from London as well?
Yeah, so it's one of my bail conditions from one of my court cases. And I just wanted to say thank you for inviting me. And I'm sorry I can't be there because of the Met Police. But actually, my bail conditions and not being out to London pales into insignificance compared to the many Palestinians living in exile across the world because of what's happening in the Israeli apartheid regime. So in terms of myself, and it's interesting what Huda said then, so I lived, it's quite a simple answer, I lived next to or very close to a factory in Kent, an Elbit factory. And when I found out what they were doing, I had to do something about it. I'm not a university educated person. I didn't have the means to go through those sort of processes. So finding out there was them there and that direct action was a way of directly stopping it without having to have massive knowledge or debate around it, I could go straight to it. And more so for me, I'd worked for a number of years with homeless people, refugees, and then asylum seekers, and in fact ended up living in a community house with lots of asylum seekers. And hearing their stories from Iraq, from Afghanistan, from Palestine, and realizing that these weapons that were built just around the corner from me were the ones that were causing them. And, you know, I'm totally up for people having freedom of movement to choose where they want to go. But these people were being forced to flee and leave because of the wars created by the British state and their friends. And therefore, for me, it felt a sort of a complete solidarity with them and going to the cause, to the root cause of it, by stopping these weapons that, as I said, were built round the corner. And as Hood has touched on, I think more and more people in these communities, these factories are often built on industrial estates or the one in Kent, for instance. There's many companies, charities, universities who work around them, and you wouldn't notice it unless it's brought to their attention, often, thankfully now, by lots of red paint all over their buildings, so no one can miss it and understand the evil that these companies perpetuate.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, and it's interesting, isn't it, that, you know, as you say, Richard, and indeed Huda, the community, by and large, you know, are opposed to these sort of companies being located in their localities. And it's just odd, isn't it? I mean, how these things actually come to pass. And I wonder, David, if you could maybe tell us a little bit about the links between conservative friends of Israel, for example, and Elbit. What's going on there?
Well, of course, the support for this kind of activity in the British community is very, very small, but their support for it in the political elite and in the lobbying elite is very strong. The Conservative Friends of Israel, led by a guy called Lord Pollock, has been used as a kind of lobbying vehicle by Elbit and by other firms as well to try and make sure that their interests are protected by the government, the British government. And, of course, there's a number of different lobbying firms involved here, the Westminster Connection and others, in which Pollock also has involvement. And there's a kind of nexus of lobbying interests at Westminster which have Elbit's back. Mm. But we don't see that. And people, they come to the realization that there are these factories down the road, and they're shocked and horrified. And you know, the other half of that is, which we should be shocked and horrified about, is that in Westminster there are small groups of people who are determined that companies like Elbit should be allowed to continue to trade, and people like Lord Pollock, the head of the Conservative Friends of Israel, are absolutely key to that initiative. So they need to be targeted as well.
Mm, yes. I mean, and Huda, I mean, apparently there's some sort of connection between Elbit and India. I wonder if you could say a little bit about what that's all about.
Yeah, definitely. So India is actually the largest importer of arms from Israel, and often these weapons are used against the occupied Kashmiri people. And these weapons are first actually marketed as battle-tested or developed on the captive population of Gaza and on the Palestinian people. So they're used against one occupied people, developed on them, and then sent to be used on another occupied people, which just shows really our struggles are connected in terms of the resistance and the horrors that both groups face in terms of occupation. But also, it's the same companies that profit from both of them. And it also means it's the same targets that we can unite on, especially in places like we're seeing in Oldham, in Leicester, in other places where people are coming together from different communities to oppose this. And the fact that they were allowed to be, you know, I think it's quite audacious, the audacious placement of these factories in communities like Leicester, in communities like Oldham, in front of the communities whose families they're basically killing back home in their own countries, but also that can also be part of their downfall and actually one of the biggest mistakes they make. Mm-hmm. And we've seen that. We've seen communities uprise against Elbit. So really, you know, the fact that, and just echoing on what you said before, I think it's really crucial that actually we know that the grassroots in this country, and actually most people, I truly believe, if you don't profit from the arms trade or benefit from it directly, you're not going to support it. The same goes for Israel's apartheid state, and it's about harnessing that community power and using it in a way which is quite powerful and directly impacts Elbit's factories and you know, harnessing the power where we have it. Yeah. And that's what we're trying to do at Palestine Action.
No, indeed. I mean, you know, the weapons industry is incredibly profitable, has been up until now. And indeed, it was a US president, wasn't it, 60 years ago, Dwight Eisenhower, who said, warned about the dangers of an expanding military industrial complex. I think it was he who coined that term. But let me, just before we go to the next VT, if I could ask you, Richard, how did Palestine Action chase Elbit out of its own London HQ? That's an incredible achievement.
Yeah, perseverance, I think, is a key word. I would say there was a twin campaign. There was obviously direct action starting, the very first action, public action that Palestine Action did. People went inside, including both myself and Huda, inside their office and covered it with paint, and then went back and back and back. At the same time, there was a campaign realizing that these companies don't operate in isolation. Capitalist companies need their landlords, need their managing agents to be able to run these buildings. So there was a twin campaign, and many people took autonomous actions across the country against the managing agents of and landlords of Elbit Systems HQ to increase that pressure on them. And also, I think it culminated in 6 weeks, the final 6 weeks, with intensive direct action, one or twice a week, people going outside, covering it with paint, making it, as Hood has already described, not possible for them to go into work. And it fits into the ideas as to what wins a direct action campaign, those five key elements. One being that the actions must be disruptive. You've got to stop them being able to operate. You've got to cause some kind of disruption. They've then got to be sustained. They can't just be one-off actions, however good it is to shut down an arms factory for a day. They must happen week in, week out. The target must be single and focused on that. And key, actually, a sort of counterintuitive one, there's got to be an element of sacrifice, which is not often popular in Western secular culture, but actually, this idea of seeing people prepared to give up their freedom, whether it be for just a few hours, prepared to end up covering themselves often in red paint when they cover it over a building, brings more people to the movement. And then the fifth thing is it creates a dilemma in this case for the company. And the dilemma is it profitable for them to even operate there anymore? Is there so much disruption and so much upset for them and their landlords and their neighbours that they have to leave? So those five key elements. And I would just add it, I think there was a poetic symmetry between actions. So the first person to go into the Albert HQ on the first public action of Palestine Action was Huda, a Palestinian. And on the final action, there were two Palestinians, including one born in Gaza, who was on the final action that closed that place down and meant that they're not operating there anymore.
Yeah, the resistance is rising, and not just in Palestine, but across the globe and certainly in the UK. But we're just going to have to pause it there for a moment to this report on the official response to the success of Palestine Action.
Palestine Action have Israel's largest arms manufacturer, Elbit Systems, staggering in Britain. In 6 months alone, the group has forced Elbit to sell a subsidiary in Oldham and abandon the London headquarters in Holborn. Despite battering Elbit across the map of England, not one Palestine actionist has been convicted of any crime. In fact, several have already been acquitted in the notoriously harsh magistrate's court, where the guilt of the accused is assessed by a judge rather than jury. In the past, Palestine actionists have argued that Elbit Systems fear being brought before the courts and their function as a producer of killing machines being analysed in depth by a jury consisting of members of the public. Now, Priti Patel, the former International Development Secretary, who was forced to resign for having 13 secret meetings with Israeli officials, in which she offered to provide British taxpayer funds to the Zionist entity, has proposed new legislation which seems to be targeted at Palestine Action. The National Security Bill would give the British police the authority to designate places where Elbit's materials are held as prohibited spaces. It is thought that this move could grant Elbit factories a protected status. This totalitarian law would make possible life imprisonment for anyone who is judged to have behaved in a way which is prejudicial to the safety or interest of the United Kingdom. It is important to note that Elbit has several existing contracts with the Ministry of Defence to provide the British Armed Forces with hardware. Another potential indicator of Palestine Action-related state machinations is the visit of Israeli police to the London Borough of Hackney. In a tweet which was subsequently deleted following a backlash, the Hackney police proudly welcomed the Israeli police on their visit to the borough. It's been wondered by many if this visit directly relates to attempts to suppress Palestine Action and their victory role against Elbit. The Muslim Association of Britain spoke out, condemning the visit as indefensible. Israeli police violently attacked mourners and pallbearers at Shireen Abu Akleh's funeral just a few days ago, and they routinely raid Al-Aqsa Mosque, arresting and assaulting worshippers. How were they welcomed and allowed to freely parade in one of the most ethnically diverse constituencies in London, with one of the biggest Muslim communities in the UK, given their appalling violence, racism, and Islamophobia? Judging by the swift deletion of the tweet, it seems like Hackney Police's collaboration with Israeli police has gone underground for now. The history of British collaboration with the Zionist colonization of Palestine is long and sordid. But is the campaign against Elbit deepening those bonds? What is the extent of integration between British and Israeli security services in the war against Palestine Action?
Huda, what do you make of this new legislation that's being pushed by Priti Patel?
I think it just shows how deep the alliance is between Britain and the apartheid state. And the more and more we've taken action against Elbit Systems, the more we see the state show their hand and really their true support for the colonisation of Palestine and their complete disregard for the lives of the Palestinian people, who Britain has been complicit in their colonisation for over 100 years. So it's not necessarily surprising, but I think it does show as well that they're pretty desperate to crack down and stop the activities of Palestine Action. And they're currently spending a lot of time, or wasting their time, focusing on trying to legislate against us. And at the same time, many activists are spending their time trying to get rid of Elbit sites as soon as possible. So we're keeping an eye on it, but it's definitely not going to stop the activities of Palestine Action, and it won't stop the campaign to get rid of Elbit Systems in this country.
No. Well, good luck with everything you're doing. But, Richard, I wonder if you could maybe outline how Palestine Action differs from other pro-Palestine organisations in the UK.
Yeah, I think the first thing I want to say is there's obviously been many groups, individuals and groups doing sterling work for many years. In fact, often people, including maybe in this studio, who've been doing it for longer than some of our activists have been born. And that is all vital and important work. And we have great links with local solidarity groups and other groups, Friends of Al-Aqsa. And often there's an interchangeability between people who are involved in either ones. I think our difference is obviously we're focused solely on direct action. That's a focus on that because in this particular part of the struggle, in the struggle against the arms trade, in the struggle against Elbit Systems, I'm afraid the political process is gone. And appealing to the oppressors is just never going to work. And people have tried that for many years. And obviously Corbyn was a hope for many people. But that's not going to happen. There's literally probably one MP now who might be on side. So this is a direct action focused movement that complements the other things that other people are doing, and a single focus that means that. And that's our main difference. I would also say, I think one of our maybe unintended successes is drawing many new people into the Palestinian cause, from the environmental movement, from animal rights. I know, Chris, you've been on those two ones for a long time, but not everyone sees that. And these people, and especially young people, we have many people of all ages, genders, religions, but there's a high proportion of young people who I think understand that the political process is broken. They've seen the way it's treated people like you. They've seen Extinction Rebellion and other groups come forward and use similar tactics, and they understand, and they also hear the words of Palestinians who cannot wait any longer for those things and want to go straight to the source. And I think that's how we differ or complement the other things that are happening.
Indeed. Well, I mean, I think your point about young people just certainly gives us hope for the future. But David, I mean, how do you see the trajectory of Elbit? I mean, do you think their retreat is going to continue?
Well, let's hope so. I mean, the pattern is beginning to be set, and let's hope it does. I mean, and this will be, if we do this, and, you know, Palestine Action in the vanguard of it, then that's a first major victory for Palestine solidarity work in this country, which will take things in a different direction. Of course, there are many other targets lining up behind Elbit. There are many, many ways in which both the arms industry and Zionism more generally are organized throughout this country. And they have many, many, many places where they organize, where they are based, law firms they're associated with, charities through which they work. And all of these are organizations which will, you know, line up behind Elbit as being the targets next. So I foresee this as being, you know, the beginning of a number of dominoes.
Sure.
And what we need to do is push over the first few dominoes, and the rest will start to fall.
Yeah. I mean, suppose it's just another indication, isn't it, of the growth of the resistance, as I was saying earlier. We saw how the resistance in Gaza last year pushed back the Israeli occupation forces during that bombardment, and we're seeing, you know, the fantastic work of Palestine Action, you know, in this country making such a huge impact. But I mean, that's resulting, isn't it, Huda? I think your work, your campaigning on the Palestinian issues in being deplatformed. I think you were deplatformed, weren't you, by Constant Contact recently? And I wonder if you could say what other groups have deplatformed you as a result of your activities.
Yeah, so we've been regularly deplatformed. Many, you know, most organisations or groups rely on certain platforms such as Facebook. We got taken down from them in the first 2 months. It didn't take long. MailChimp, PayPal, DonorBox. The list goes on. But really what we saw was a pattern. And Chuffed actually told us that the reason that they were removing us was because Elbit's lawyers were threatening to sue them and that they couldn't afford to take on a lawsuit from Elbit's lawyers. So they were the only ones and the first ones to actually come forward and explain what was going on behind the background and the reasoning for these deplatforming from these sites. But really, you know, we'll always find different ways to get our message across and to reach our supporters. But at the same time, I think it's almost amusing that they're spending so much money and time on chasing these websites in a bid to try and stop us.
And not only that, of course. I mean, we've got organisations like the Jewish Chronicle, secretly recording your meetings. What's his name? David Collier, who's an asset of the Israeli regime, also secretly recording Palestine Action Zoom meeting. I mean, just very briefly, in the closing seconds, what do you make of these intelligence operations against you?
I think it just shows their desperation and their bid to stop us. And we've seen this in the past, and we're going to continue to see this going forward. If you are in any way effective or making change or getting your voices out there, then there is going to be a reaction from those who support the apartheid state and from those Zionist lobby groups. And so we expect that as part of the resistance fighting for an end to Elbit systems. Mm. But it's definitely not enough to scare us away.
No, well, indeed. Well, you're an inspiration, Huda, and thank you for joining us today. Thank you, Richard, for joining us as well. And obviously, thank you to David, our resident expert. I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, as unfortunately we're out of time. We'll be back next week with more analysis and investigations on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The Limelight. The U.S. Supreme Court this week embraced a vision of the Second Amendment that is profoundly at odds with precedent and the dangers that American communities face today, upending the long-standing practice of letting states decide for themselves how to regulate gun possession in public. The article you're about to hear has been written by the editorial board of the New York Times. The piece has been published in the opinion section of the newspaper and is titled, "The Supreme Court Puts Gun Rights Above the Human Life." The U.S. Supreme Court this week embraced the vision of the Second Amendment that is profoundly at odds with precedent and the dangers that American communities face today, upending the long-standing practice of letting states decide for themselves how to regulate gun possession in public. This decision reveals the vast gulf between ideologues on the Supreme Court and those Americans, ordinary people, and their representatives in Congress who want this country to be safer from guns. As the High Court issued its 135-page ruling, the Senate, across the street, approved an 80-page bipartisan bill that tightens restrictions on who can possess and purchase a gun. The House of Representatives passed the bill on Friday, and President Biden signed it on Saturday. This breakthrough came after decades of virtually no congressional action on gun safety and was fueled by public outrage over a series of mass shootings, including the recent massacres in Uvalde, Texas, and in Buffalo, New York. Gun enthusiasts and gun manufacturers have long sought a ruling like the one the Supreme Court delivered on Thursday, its decision in the case New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruen, is an assertion that the Second Amendment trumps reasonable efforts to protect public safety. The United States, as it exists today, awash in insufficiently regulated high-powered weapons and afflicted by staggeringly high rates of gun homicide and suicide is the society that their preferred policies have created. The best that gun control advocates can hope for after the Bruin ruling is what Congress passed, gradual legislative tinkering. In its 6-3 ruling, the supermajority of Republican-appointed justices struck down a century-old New York law that placed strict limits on handguns. But the decision will also affect similar laws elsewhere in New Jersey, Massachusetts, Maryland, Hawaii, and California. Many of those are states with some of the lowest rates of gun deaths in the country. Extensive research has shown the strict regulation of guns leads to much fewer deaths. Relying on a highly selective reading of history, Justice Clarence Thomas wrote in his majority opinion that these gun restrictions violate the court's new interpretation of the Second Amendment. It was only in 2008, with its decision in District of Columbia versus Heller, that conservatives on the Supreme Court divined an individual right to bear arms hidden somewhere in the 27 words of the Second Amendment. New York's law requires that a person seeking a concealed carry permit for a handgun must show a good reason for doing so, known as proper cause, which covers law enforcement officers and others who can demonstrate a reason to fear for their own safety. We know of no other constitutional right that an individual may exercise only after demonstrating to government officers some special need, Justice Clarence Thomas wrote. It is not how the Second Amendment works when it comes to public carry for self-defense. The majority left open the ability of states to ban guns from certain sensitive places, such as schools and government buildings, but it cautioned that there is no historical basis for New York to effectively declare the island of Manhattan a sensitive place. What about, for instance, the subway, the site of a mass shooting in April? The court didn't say, as Justice Stephen Breyer noted in his dissent. That leaves an opening for the states to decide which spaces are off limits. New York Governor Kathy Hochul plans to call the legislature back for a special session to address the ruling for just that reason. Lawmakers will consider legislation that could designate New York's public transit system a sensitive place, alongside schools, parks, hospitals, and office buildings, and buffer zones around them. The state should also institute extensive training requirements for concealed weapons permits. Lawmakers in several other states that will likely be affected by the decision said they were working to tweak their laws to meet the court's new standard for permissible firearms regulation. The Supreme Court justices bickered openly in their written opinions in the Bruin ruling, with the three liberals on the court pointing to various grim statistics on mass shootings and suicides, while Justice Samuel Alito asked what any of those deaths had to do with handgun regulations. Their discord reflects a grim truth about gun violence in the United States. It is several distinct and deadly crises happening simultaneously. Suicides by firearms, homicides related to domestic violence, gang killings, and spectacular mass shootings. Cities, states, and federal government have approached these overlapping crises in various ways and with varying degrees of success. Broadly speaking, regulating guns saves lives. More guns and less regulation of them results in more deaths. The new legislation aims to tackle several types of gun violence at the same time. called the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act. The law will enhance background checks for potential gun buyers under the age of 21, which might have helped thwart the mass shooting incident in Uvalde, Texas. It directs millions of dollars to states to put in place so-called red flag laws or other crisis intervention efforts which will help stop domestic violence-related killings and also suicides. It adds serious dating partners to the list of domestic abusers prohibited from buying guns, which is now limited to spouses and domestic partners. It also directs millions of dollars to mental health and school safety programs. The specifics of this bill matter. Of equal importance is the fact that the bipartisan legislation tackles an issue that has stymied Congress for decades. It isn't quite true, as some supporters of the new bill claim, that there hasn't been any gun control legislation passed in the past 30 years. Congress passed, and President Donald Trump signed, a minor update to the National Instant Criminal Background Check System in 2018. But no legislation equal to the size of the problem has made it to a president's desk. With this new limited law, however, lawmakers are at least responding to the fundamental mandate of every elected government to protect its citizens. Given the political paralysis in Congress on so many other issues, any progress on guns is progress worth making.
Insight. Welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing Iran-Russia relations with Russian Ambassador to Iran, Levan Jagarian. But first, let's take a look at this brief analysis.
Iran and Russia are entering into a new strategic era in their relationship. The West's sanctions and overreactions, and its failure to isolate Russia following the war in Ukraine, has resulted in a strategic reorientation of Russia towards the East and South, which includes Iran. Iran itself is taking full advantage of a new emerging multipolar world order and declining U.S. power, and is enhancing its strategic relations with emerging powers from around the world, from China in East Asia to Venezuela in South America. After all, Iranians witnessed the failure of the JCPOA process and the failure of the nearly 30-year attempt by certain Western-oriented Iranian elites to create rapprochement with the West, only to be embarrassingly rejected by the US itself. Iran is confidently pursuing its national interests with its non-Western neighbors in Asia and friends and allies around the world, and closing the book on strategic rapprochement with the West. After a period of naivety and sophomoric false hopes about the West and America among Iranian and Russian elites in the 1990s and early 21st century, everyone in Iran and Russia has now witnessed the fundamental enmity of American and Western elites to the very existence of an independent and powerful Iran and Russia, which can effectively contain, roll back, and expel America from Eurasia as it tries to maintain its fast-fading claims to global hegemony. Iran and Russia have made a good start into this new strategic era. However, a number of issues remain to be resolved, particularly in the field of trade and economics. Once these issues are resolved and Iran and Russia sign the strategic agreement that is currently being finalized, Zbigniew Brzezinski's and America's nightmare scenario of the strategic alignment of Iran, Russia, and China will be complete. moving the world faster into the post-American era of contemporary human history.
Ambassador Jagarian, thank you so much for joining us on Insight. As you know, our program is more of a conversation. Yeah. We want to get into the issues in a more deep fashion. We want to talk about it more from a historic, strategic perspective. And so with that in mind, there's a lot of things we need to cover in our conversation. I want to start with the thing that's unfortunately dominating the news, which is the special military operation in the Ukraine that was conducted and is still being conducted by the Russian Federation. We heard that at the beginning of this of the military operation, we had President Putin, we had Minister Lavrov, and various other officials talking about what would be the political end game of this operation. What is it that should happen politically for Russia to end the special military operation? So I would like to start a conversation with you, please explaining to us, telling us a little bit, giving us a little insight into what is it that is going to be required for this military, special military operation to end from the perspective of the Russian Federation.
First of all, thanks a lot for your questions. Thanks a lot for this beautiful opportunity to explain our position in this regard. Very good question. You know, for a long time, since the very beginning, and long ago, even since the end of the last year, we were talking about the necessity for the Ukraine to be a neutral country, mm-hmm. not to join NATO,
yes.
not to violate the balance of force in Europe, because we do believe that it was a plan initiated by Americans and their allies to create Ukraine as a project anti-Russia.
Yes.
To damage Russian interests, to damage yes. Russian security. That's why we were strongly against, let's say, full membership. Anyway, a membership of the Ukraine in NATO. Only be partiality. It was our main demand. But unfortunately, the European countries and the Americans, they just ignored Russian legitimate demands, mm-hmm. expectations. Frankly speaking, you know, I do believe that this provocation, mm-hmm. which was organized by Americans in the Ukraine, was a sort of attempt to deflect attention mm-hmm. of the world from their defeat in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They were just in Afghanistan for more than 20 years, together with their European and not only allies, and they were defeated. It was a sort of disgraceful defeat of the United States of America and allies in Afghanistan. I would like to repeat it once again. Disgraceful defeat of Americans in Afghanistan. And it would be very interesting to listen about the reasons of this defeat. But Americans will never tell you.
Yes.
That's why they decided to withdraw their troops from Afghanistan, and were witnessing of this video when they were escaping Kabul airport, yes. like cowards, and they wanted to like to finish their disgraceful operation in Afghanistan and to focus on the Ukraine to create problems for us. You know that our demands of the military operation to Ukraine, special military operation, there are five well-known goals: mm-hmm. denazification,
yes.
demilitarization, neutral status, recognition of the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republic as independent countries,
yes.
and to recognize Crimea, which historically belongs to Russia and was gifted yes. during Soviet time as a gift, as a chocolate, to the Ukraine in 1954 as a part of the Russian Federation. It took place after a referendum, which was conducted in 2014.
Yes.
After illegal coup d'etat in the Ukraine, if you remember.
Yes.
It wasn't a democratic transition of power in the Ukraine. It was coup d'etat supported by the so-called Democrats in the West. So what we see now? Unfortunately, the people are being killed, a lot of refugees, but it's not our choice. We were forced to do that to defend the interests of Russians who have been living from Donbass for centuries.
Yes.
And we will continue our special military operation till we reach our five goals. As to the negotiations, you know, initially Ukrainians were ready to negotiate. There were some rounds of negotiations, and this last one was in Istanbul. And we are very grateful for the Turkish government to create the possibility for such negotiations. But, you know, then, unfortunately, Ukrainians withdraw from their previous readiness to negotiate with us because the Ukrainian regime, they are independent.
They were under pressure.
Under pressure and under influence of the USA, not Brussels.
The Americans.
The Americans, of course. And they are waiting for instructions from Washington what to do. So it's very difficult.
Excuse me, Mr. Ambassador. So the Europeans might have even been supportive of these talks, but it was the Americans that do not want the Ukraine to.
You know, Europeans are right now under total domination of the United States of America.
Okay.
Unfortunately, they have lost their own say. Right now, Europeans, they need such charismatic leaders like Jacques Chirac in France. Charles de Gaulle, yes. Georges Pompidou.
Independent.
In Germany, Helmut Kohl, Willy Brandt.
Yes.
We don't have such charismatic leaders like
now. The level of leadership in Europe is very low.
Yes, unfortunately, unfortunately. We would like to see strong and independent Europe. We don't cast shadow on their, let's say, Euro-Atlantic solidarity relationship with the United States, the alliance, NATO, of course. But there are a lot of issues that they pragmatically must follow their own interests.
Exactly. And we see there's a lot of consequences now for a lot of the countries in Europe in terms of energy, in terms of prices, in terms of all the things that are, as a matter of reality, in fact, making them dependent or requiring them to have good relations with Russia.
Yes.
All these things are being disregarded.
Unfortunately. I would like to repeat once again. We would like to see strong, united, but independent Europe.
Exactly.
Because, you know, it's a sort of humiliation.
It's embarrassing. And it's very interesting you mentioned this, Mr. Ambassador, because we have a very similar experience with that in Iran, which is they have interest in Iran. They've had interest in Iran for many decades, but they're not able to defend it in terms of, you know, economic and other things.
Yeah,
and we see that, like you said, there's no independent leadership in Europe for whatever reason. This is also an interesting thing that
in GCPOA, for example, in terms of GCPOA.
So, Mr. Ambassador, it's very good now that I want to now move to what I think is actually the most important issue that has come out of this crisis that we are experiencing, which is that this crisis has become a catalyst, an accelerator, an event, a historic event, which is transforming the global order.
Yes.
There were indications of this happening before the crisis happened, before the special military operation began, in terms of how the world was moving, a certain level of decline that has occurred in America, maybe even a great level of decline, as you were talking about this sort of impotence by the Europeans, but also the rise of Eurasia, the rise of China, Iran, Russia, India, after a period of this so-called unipolar moment, or this era where the Americans were you know, commanding everyone and demanding whatever they wanted from everyone. I want to enter this issue, this idea of that there's a changing geopolitical order, maybe talk a little bit about Russia's future in this order, but I want to start this way. I've spoken to a lot of thinkers in Iran and also outside of Iran, but I haven't had a chance to talk about this from a Russian perspective, which is that we saw that in the beginning of the 21st century, 20 years ago approximately, maybe even at the late 1990s, the dominant view among many of the elites in Russia and in Iran was one that they had a positive view towards the West. And I would say maybe a little bit naive, maybe a little bit of a view where they didn't understand the essence of who they were dealing with. But what I mean by that, I mean that when you look at the behavior of the Americans, especially in the last 20 years, it is clear that for them it was never about coming to a mutually agreeable relationship, respectful. It was about diktat, about dictating things. And we see that particularly in the case of Russia and Iran, there seems to be a essential opposition to the existence of these two nations. And the reason, I would argue, is because from maybe the 19th century, the Westerners, whether it was the British or the Americans, knew that if Iran and Russia are strong, they would not be able to influence Europe, West Asia, that their hegemony in the area that they are assuming is dependent on these two countries not even existing. So could we talk a little bit about, is it time that we learned the lesson from this history, both in Russia and in Iran, that maybe we made some mistakes in the early 20th century about our view about what the Americans are, the essence of how their relationship is with us? Of course, you're a diplomat. I'm not asking you to say something that's... I'm saying it as a researcher.
Lucky you are.
Yeah, thank you very much.
When I retire, I will speak like you. But right now, I should be a little bit more cautious. But anyway, about the existence of Russia and Iran, they would like to see us as a puppets.
Exactly.
Not as independent countries.
Exactly.
Because I think a main slogan of America is, if you don't agree with me, you are against me and I will punish you.
Exactly. This is what they've done in action.
That's why they don't have friends. When they say we have friends, allies, they are not neither friends nor allies. We understand it quite well.
Exactly.
You know, in Russia, after the dissolution of the former Soviet Union, we have got a lot of freedoms in our country. A new page we opened in our bilateral relations with America, with Europe. No enmity anymore. And the Cold War was over, and they thought that they won the Cold War, and they can dictate their will, their wish, their demands to others, especially to Russia. And at that time, we were very weak, of course.
Yes.
And very naive, let's be frank. Me too. Mm-hmm. Me too, because I have started my diplomatic career as a foreign minister of the Soviet Union.
Yes.
And I continued to till now, and we believe that we can open a new page in our relations with the United States and Europe. But we understood after the 90s that it was a very wrong perception, because their real intention was not to establish, let's say, normal, equal relations with the Russian Federation, with other countries, but only to establish their domination and to dictate their will to others, to impose their point of view.
Yes.
And right now, when I talk to some of my colleagues, I tell them that when I put parallels between socialist or communist era and your behavior right now in the European countries, I find a lot of similarities.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. So you're saying that the behavior of the Americans
since the
not
European
very
allies.
Different from the time of the Soviet Union.
No, because it's similar. You know, I tell them, you are like communists right now. Uh-huh. I call them neo-communists, you know.
Right.
They don't want to listen to other opposite point of view.
Right.
Opposite point of view is unacceptable for them.
Yes.
That's why they must combat with them. And you know that it is unacceptable. We are the only ones that have very right decision.
And the only ones that have interest. Nobody else has any interest.
That's why I call Europeans neo-communists. Not all of them, but those who support Americans. Because in Europe there are a lot of people, very wise, very pragmatic, who disagree with American domination, disagree with American policy, disagree with the policy of their governments. They are wise enough to defend their pragmatic interests.
Exactly.
I would tell only for that, for example, there is one government, one country in Europe who tries to defend their pragmatic interests because they do understand that, first of all, the priority of their government is the interest of their own people. The country is Hungary.
Yes, exactly.
I would like to use the possibility to say once again that the wise and pragmatic policy is very important for Hungarian people. I do believe it's their domestic issue. I don't want to interfere. But it's my point, own opinion. That's why it's very important, you know. They cut all contacts with us. Channels of communication and the level of ambassadors. How does it come? Very childish, let me be frank. I expected them to be more serious.
Well, on that note, I want to make a little humor with you. I would like to welcome you to the club that Iran has been in for the last 30 years. Now you are experiencing some of the things that we've been experiencing as it relates to sanctions and this childish, unreasonable behavior, because every country has its own interests. And this is something that everybody realizes. It's interesting. We have recently statements by none other than Henry Kissinger talking about the West should take Russia's interest into account. So, you know, Henry Kissinger is saying it, and nobody accuses Henry Kissinger of being a Russian spy or Russian.
Yes, yeah, sure.
We even have, just in continue what you were mentioning, we have a person which maybe a lot of people are not familiar with, but in within the Russian sphere, Dmitry Trenin, who is, you know, so-called liberal intelligentsia, a person which is famous for being pro-Western in Russia, part of the Carnegie Endowment after, you know, the collapse of the Soviet Union, basically a symbol of what we're talking about, which is a group or a significant part of the intelligentsia being pro-Western. So this person now has come out and has written an article and has publicly stated that this reaction that we saw from the West to the special military operation by the Russians is so overblown, is so irrational, that it's clear to him, somebody who is a flag bearer of westernization or becoming close to the West, for him it's clear that this is now a war against Russia itself. So this is very interesting. We had similar experiences here in Iran with JCPOA, you know, for 30 years, people trying to get to some agreement, and we see we are all stuck. After 30 years, we're stuck. So with that, I think if we are able to learn, if the elites, if some of the decision makers are able to learn that lesson in Iran and Russia, let's move now to how you see the future in terms of this changing global order. I will just mention a few headlines. Shanghai Cooperation Organization, Eurasian integration, using, you know, our national currencies for trade. How do you see this emerging new global order coming about? And where do you see Russia being in this new emerging global order in the future?
First of all, Russia has become a stronghold against American, let's say, Americans and their allies to establish their domination in the world. And now we are living in a very sensitive moment. Mm-hmm. I do believe that we will defeat Nazis in the Ukraine. They are Nazis. It is one of our goals. Unfortunately, many European countries, governments, support the Nazis in the Ukraine. Even those who were just massacred during Second World War by Stepan Bandera, the close associate of Hitler.
Yes.
That's why makes all of us surprised. As you mentioned, the liberals in Russia, of course, but they are in a minority, mm-hmm. and they have the right to have their own opinion.
Of course, but even they are realizing that what the essence of this issue is.
And I would like to say, to underline, that the major part of Russian population fully supports the policy of my president, mm-hmm. because they do believe that only the victory, and I have no doubt that we will win in this military operation. They will achieve our goals, and we support our president because he is defending our interests, the interests of the Russian population. As you mentioned, Shanghai Cooperation Organization, Eurasia, we have got very good lesson. And we tried to establish good, normal relations with European countries, with the European Union before 2014. But we understood that, their real intention was to create problems for Russia, mm-hmm. because not only for Russia, for Iran, for China, for other independent countries. That's why we are witnessing the orientation of the Russian foreign policy, economic policy towards East,
yes.
and towards South,
yes.
and our friends who didn't join sanctions, who supported Russia, Chinese People's Republic, Iran, India, some other countries.
The majority of non-Western countries.
Yes.
There's a famous map that was, you know, gone online. All the countries except for the Western countries didn't join the Global South, Latin America, Africa.
You know, when some Western journalists are talking to Russian diplomats or Russian officials, they say international community disagrees, and we are asked a question, who are you to speak in behalf of the international community? You can speak in behalf of Western part of the Western countries, not the people, not exactly. The people. Look what's going on in European countries, prices, inflation, and our message is don't blame Putin, don't blame Russia for your problems, blame your own governments, your mistakes. You have committed a lot of mistakes.
Mr. Ambassador, it's very interesting.